Accession number 9968, reel 3.
Mr. Smith, reel 3.
The crew, of course, knew more about the convoy, ships in the convoy, than me, that were round us. And I knew that the Fort McMurray was nearby, and the crew thought that the Fort McMurray had taken the torpedoes. Obviously, she'd gone, the ship. And later in the day, it was cleared up. We got a light signal, which we always use, of course, there was no radio used between the ships. It was either flags or the Aldis lamp at sea. And it seemed that it was the... I think it was the Maratha. They said it was a destroyer. But I never cleared it up. But since then, I've read, and the time seems to coincide with that experience, that it was Maratha, M-A-H-R-A-T-T-A, I believe. And that's all I can think it was. It was just after midnight. But anyway, since if it was the Maratha, there were only six picked up, I believe. It was so cold. And...
What date was this approximately?
Well, this was 1943, late, I think, because we spent a Christmas there. Spent a Christmas in Murmansk.
What was that like in Murmansk?
Murmansk. It was the most depressing place I've ever been in. It was covered with snow each time I went, and there was nothing there, and apparently the... The civilian houses had been knocked about by bombing raids, because I think we're only, maybe I'm wrong, but I think we're only about 30 or 40 miles from the German-Russian line there, because the Germans were after cutting the Murmansk Railway, I think, at the time. And that's about all you could say for Murmansk. There was nothing there. It was there was a small building they used as a club for Allied seamen, and we used to go there and... that was one of the times I got drunk in my life.
Yes?
We were allowed three vodkas, and strangely enough, there were girls waiting on the table, the waitresses, and they were Polish. They weren't Russian. I could never understand that. And I always remember having little discussions with them about things like religion, and one of them telling me, she said, well, I'm not superstitious, she said. We were told that we could only have three vodkas, but being 22 or 23, whatever, in my 20s, we didn't take a lot to notice, and I got too many. I moved from the vodka table to the Caucasian wine table, and that seemed to be as strong as the vodka. And the thing I remember after that do was being in the snow and somebody finding me in the snow. How I didn't freeze to death, I don't know. But I remember some of my pals saying... shut up. I was on an American wagon, apparently. There was two Americans in the driving seat there at the front, so they told me. And I wasn't over keen on the Americans then, because it seemed to me that when we were in convoy going up there, they were chucking depth charges over, even if they got a sound on the Asdic gear. They simply splattered the water with depth charges. Sleep was out of the question, and sometimes I think they were just false alarms. But anyway, that was beside the point. I owe them a debt of gratitude, because I think I would have froze to death in the snow if they hadn't picked me up. And they took me back to the ship, and that was the last time I tasted vodka abroad. And
did you have any contact with the Russians?
In what way?
In any way?
Yes,
you talk
aboard
to them?
The ship. Yes, we did. Yes, we were paid, which the government wouldn't have liked at the time. They'd income taxed us, I suppose. They paid us £2 an hour if we'd check out the cargo. We had a cargo manifest, and we simply marked off the cargo as it was taken ashore, and they gave us 2 shillings an hour.
Who did, the Russians?
No, the ship, the line. The people who owned the ship gave us the £2 an hour, and we simply... ticked it off the manifest. Tanks, guns, searchlights, tanks or whatever, ammunition, everything. And I remember once unloading a terrific size crate. It must have been 6 feet square, and apparently it was for the Moscow mission, the British people up there, and somebody had broken into it in Liverpool, I believe. And You could lift the lid off and you could see what was inside. There were razor blades and all the comforts of home for them, particularly razor blades. And I've always remembered this point. Somebody had left a coin in. I believe it's an old superstition, isn't it, about a sharp edge. Giving a coin for a sharp edge, I've heard that before. And I think that's with the reason. We found the coin in the bottom of the case. And that was it there. But we used to, when we were on the ship, of course, we didn't actually do seaman's work, but we were called to the lifeboats. You see, during the war, the lifeboats were slung outboard all the time. Because they had to be dropped quickly if you were torpedoed. They had to be dropped quickly. You wouldn't have had time to swing them out if you were fully loaded. Some ships went in 2 and 3 minutes, particularly if you were carrying things like iron ore. And anyway...
You said you had some contact with the Russians.
Oh, yes, we did, yeah. We used to go down in the hold and help, you know, tick them off the ship's manifest down in the hold. And with lights rigged above, which were immediately put out as soon as there was an air raid warning given. But the Russians used to be taking the cargo out with slings and, of course, the derricks. And, as I say, all we did was tick the numbers off. But there's a point I never mentioned when we were going through the White Sea. We took tons and tons of coal on the foredeck because... The two Russian icebreakers were coal burners, and they used to take it in a scoop, and each scoop was counted so many tons. And we did it in... we counted the weight simply by four lines and then the line through the four, which meant 5 tons. And that's how we refuelled the coal burners. But as we were saying, we used to just tick up the stuff off the manifest, and the Russians used to... worked 12 hours. There were people working there unloading the ships, and we were told that a lot of them were convicts. They'd been sent up there deliberately to work. And there may have been, but I know this, they worked 12-hour shifts. And what I saw of the food they ate was a cabbage soup, a scoop in the middle of the 12 hours. I remember that perfectly well.
A scoop of soup,
you know. They got, what would you call them? A ladle. A ladle of soup, and it was always cabbage soup. It smelled vile, and it seemed to consist mainly of cabbage soup. And
Did they work hard?
Well, they didn't work any harder than they had to. I never found them doing that. And I remember an incident once. There was no room to store the stuff under cover. It was stored out in the open, particularly the stuff that wouldn't perish, like tinned foods. We took a lot of tinned meats up there. And I know for a fact that these people used to get so much time for the break in the middle of the 12 hours. And one day a shot was heard, and we wondered what it was. And the truth of this I can't vouch for, but they said that one of the men had refused to get up who was working, and the officer had shot him. I don't know if this is true, but that was the story we were told.
Who told you that?
Well, the people we were working with on deck, the Russians. And anyway, that's about all that happened there. There was nothing else to do. You could go to the club. Oh, another thing that stands out in my mind, though, is one night I was going to this club on my own, you see, and we were given glasses. The cold was so severe it hurt your eyes. It was so severe it hurt your eyes. It really did. So I used these glasses we were issued with. They were like a motorcycle goggle with a fur round it so it didn't stick to the eye, to the skin, rather. And I remember wearing these that night and going ashore, and I bumped into this Russian soldier, and I think he was a major. That's all I could figure out, that he was a major. And he talked in fractured English. He said, will you do me a favour? Well, we'd been warned about security because we're friendly enemies, weren't we? And he said, will you post this postcard for me in England? And I recognised it as a radio arm's postcard. They used to have, in large letters, their station call number. He said, I used to be a radio arm before the war. He says, would you post this in England? And I said, yes, I would. But when I went aboard, of course, I gave it to the skipper and asked him if he'd hand it over to the right people, because you couldn't be sure, could you? And that was the only encounter that really bothered me. It was an officer, without a doubt. But where the postcard went to, I don't know. And then, of course, on the last trip I did, when we were coming back, we got this warning. There was something brewing. We knew there was. And the alarms went, and I used to be able to see with the glasses on the ships nearest to us, the gun crews dashing to the gun post, to the guns. And the system was that the destroyer, if she picked up a U-boat, would immediately put the black flag up. And then, of course, all the ships who saw this followed suit because you couldn't use radio. And if you couldn't do that, that was to use the Aldis light. And the black flag would be then passed right along the convoy, which I remember we used to be about perhaps 30 in a convoy, generally something about like 30. And if it was an aircraft attack that was imminent, I remember it, the flags by, I think I remember it by saying AI. I know it didn't fit, but you're reminded of it, you see. And I believe it was a blue and red flag. In any case,
What do you mean you remembered it by AI?
Those were the actual letters they used for an aircraft attack about to start, that they were coming in close. And anyway, oh dear.
That's all right.
And anyway, what used to happen was the black flag would go up, everybody would copy, and anybody that could pass a signal on with the light, the Aldis lamp, did so. And at the same time, the ship's hooters were going to warn them to get to the gun posts immediately. And I remember this time, all the escort, and we'd quite a big escort at that time, I think we'd nearly 20. You see, they used to be big ships like the cruisers at about a range of about, I didn't know this till after the war, or else I'd have felt a lot happier. But I believe there were big ships, the cruisers, Belfast and people like that, about 70 miles away from us. We didn't know that at the time. But we had quite a lot of destroyers round us, which you could see quite well, plainly dashing round. And that was the system. You just simply pass the signal on as best you could and onto your gun point, you see, and that was it. And some ships had a telephone to the stern gun, you know, the big gun, or some to the machine guns. And we also had, of course, 20mm Oerlikons. I've never mentioned that, but we had those. But usually, on a Russian ship, the trips I did, we used to have at least one Bofors gun, and generally foddered. We had a 4-inch gun on the stern, anti-submarine work, which never dragged us into it. I never fired a shot at a submarine. I never saw one. I saw ships go with torpedoes, but I never saw a submarine. And then, of course, we had those horrible things called rockets on the bridge. Were quite useless.
They
fired a wires, trailing wires into the air for low-flying aircraft, and I couldn't see how they could be any good at all because the aircraft wouldn't fly directly over the top of you and soar low, or it'd have touched the masthead. But anyway, they were there, and sometimes... Oh, and we had snowflakes. We called them snowflakes. It was a rocket, and you pulled the wire. If you were torpedoed, you pulled the wire, and the snowflakes went up, and this warned the escort you'd been torpedoed. Because it was almost always dark going to Russia.
What were these snowflakes?
It was just like a firework, that you know, like sparklers coming down. And that was the signal you'd stopped a torpedo, from what I could gather. We never had to fire one, thank God. But
And these rockets, what were they supposed to do?
They trailed the wire for low-flying aircraft. They were quite useless, I think.
To impede them?
Yeah, in case they came flying low over you. Of course, on some parts... In some parts of the world, you actually, like the Red Sea, you sometimes took a barrage balloon on the stern. But, of course, it wasn't a viable proposition in storms like you've got going up to Russia. You just couldn't do that. And anyway, coming back, I remember, I didn't know this till after the war, but there was another convoy going up and we were coming home. And all our escort immediately dashed off and lights were flashing and we were left with one small... destroyer or sloop, perhaps, the Westcott. I met one of the crew in the post office after the war, worked with me. But she was the only one left with us. And I remember just hearing some dull thuds, whether they were scaring submarines off, I don't know, but we heard some dull thuds. not long afterwards. But what it was the Shianos, she'd come out, and they actually got her on that trip. But she was going for the convoy going up to Murmansk. We were coming back, so we were empty. And since then, I've actually got the book now, but since then I've found that they did choose the full convoy going up because, of course, naturally, you wouldn't take the empty convoy, not risk big ships like that on empty ships. But they got the Shianos on that trip. I know that. Of course, I've got the book now myself. But that's all I remember of it, was when these escorts dashed off and left us, and left us with just Westcott, the small destroyer. And we didn't know really what was going on. They didn't tell us anything like that. I don't suppose it would have done your morale any good to know the Shianos was too close.
Were the Russian convoys very different from other convoys?
Oh, yes, yes.
In what way?
The cold was terrible. Oh, the cold was terrible. I mean, you could get weather where it was snow. It used to come on sometimes in snowstorms, which lasted minutes or hours. And sometimes the upper structure of the ship was like glass, just like glass, you know. You couldn't, and it made them top heavy, it made them dangerous. You see, because you ran into all sorts of horrible storms, and a ship rolling could easily just go over and not come back.
Did that ever happen?
The only time I ever saw a ship actually disappear was on an Atlantic convoy when she broke her back. It was one of the welded ships, and we ran into a storm. I think it was 42. I think it was January 42. One of the biggest storms I saw, and it was shocking. There were 60-foot seas, I think, that day. Oh, it was days. And she just went into this terrible hill of water, and nothing came out, only wooden boxes at the other side. And one of the more knowledgeable members of the crew, the Merchant Navy lads, told me she was a welded job, and they were more likely to crack than the ones with rivets, you know, the riveted ships. And from what I can gather, they were rather dangerous in bad weather.
Do you know the name of the ship?
No, I can't tell you that, no. Sometimes we didn't even know the names of any of the ships in the convoy. They were just ships, and that's all we saw. Sometimes ships were sunk by torpedo, and you never knew they'd gone. You didn't even know they'd gone until it could spread over miles and miles of convoy, you see, and you wouldn't know. Or perhaps know when you got back to port. That's all. That once or twice I heard that we lost so many ships, or we lost a ship, and that's all I knew about it.
Now, your particular unit was called DEMS.
Yes.
Can you tell me more about this unit?
Well, it was controlled by the Navy. Obviously, all of our side was. It was a defensively equipped merchant shipping. You see, that was the Department of the Navy. And they also gave us our orders. We had our own barracks, we had army routine, but as soon as we got aboard those merchant ships, we came under the orders of the Navy. Because in each convoy, there was a commodore ship and a vice commodore, and these were the liaison ships between the escort ships and the merchantmen. The commodore and the vice commodore were usually retired, as it says, commodores, retired commodores about that rank, I believe. And they would take the message from the naval escorts from the light, the Aldis lamp, and then pass it on to us. They'd translate it from the book. We had books on the bridge, whereby it was all in code, of course, even the lights were in code, and they'd simply get it down on paper, and the commodore ship would be just an ordinary merchant ship and the vice commodore ship, but they'd carry a naval rating who was a skilled signaller, lights usually, with the Aldis lamp, and they'd be on the bridge for their watches, and they'd pass the messages on. And if the commodore was torpedoed, then the vice commodore took over. And I think that's how they worked. But that's how we got our orders, via the commodore ships. And before we sailed, of course, there was always a meeting of all the merchant navy skippers, usually at some place like that hotel, the Adelphi in Liverpool. They'd meet there around the table, and they'd be addressed by naval officers and told what the procedure was going to be when we got to sea and put in the picture, you know. And that's how it was run. And they simply did that. But on the merchant ships, our boss was the second mate. He was the liaison man between us and the skipper. The skipper had more to think about than us. But he took it, we took our orders from the second officer, usually. He was the gunnery officer, and he looked after us. And that was about it.
What were your duties aboard the ship, apart from manning the gun?
Manning the guns, we had no other duties except that, but we usually volunteered. Well, we did it. We kept our quarters clean. I used to, when I worked on the bridge, I learned, I've forgotten them now, but I did learn the Merchant Navy Code, which is different, the flags from the Naval Code. And I did memorise them. They weren't too hard, really. You had 0 to 9, there's no number 10, and those are the flags you use. 0 to 9, the pennants, those are pennants. And then the Merchant Navy Code, which was the letters of the alphabet, of course. And those were, they were fairly easy to remember once you got used to it. And I used to help on the bridge. The officer on the bridge used to use the oldest lamp and talk to some other ship, or some ship had talked to us. And while he was taking the message, he'd call it out to me, the letters. And I'd take these letters down, and then he'd go off and have a look in the code book and see what they were. But sometimes, I must admit, I had a crafty look myself to see what was going on. You got nosy, you see, when you were on the bridge all the time. But signalling had nothing to do with us, really. Nothing at all. We merely had to do that. But in storms, which were very often, we used to be called out even if you were in bed. If you were in your bunk, you were called out and the boats had to be brought inboard. See? They had to be brought inboard. Otherwise, the waves were so high in an Atlantic storm, or, say, Cape Horn, down at the bottom of South America, it just simply lifted the boat at the side of the ship and took it with it, smashed it to pieces. I never mentioned it, but on the Clan McNair, we lost all the boats on one side going down to Magellan, you know, down to the Magellan Straits, and then coming across the Atlantic. That was 42, wasn't it? I remember I came home on leave, and my wife and I, I've got that McNair in the wrong place, but I remember seeing at the Molly Street Picture House a newsreel, and I saw our own convoy. And one of the destroyers had a jury-rigged sail-up. I remember seeing it on the news, on the Gormant News. And that was about it. But we only had three lifeboats. Three had gone. And we'd had them replaced at New York, the other three. But they went again on the same side. We went into a terrible storm in the Atlantic. It was all as bad as we saw in the South Atlantic.
Did you feel that your transfer to the Marine Department of the Royal Artillery had been a good move then?
For me? Hmm. Oh, yes. I travelled, I saw lots of places. I went all over the place. In fact, there's only one regret. I never got to Australia. I always wanted to go there. But I found, and I was backed up in this, that once you'd been in a successful shoot, they had you earmarked then for places like the Russian convoys and the Malta convoys, you know, when you proved you could shoot straight. And that was about it. But we got all over the place. I mean, I went to India. On the Empress of Russia, we took 5,000 troops to Port Tewfik. I didn't put that down on that form, did I? But Port Tewfik. Tewfik, I believe it's on the maps. But the troops call it Port Tewfik. And I found that so many of them were from Bradford on the Empress of Russia. That was the ship. I was amazed. Lots of them were RASC. In fact, I met one chap, a chap called George Bromley, I think his name was. I was walking on deck one day and the RASC instructors had blackboards on deck and they had all the men round them doing engine maintenance on the blackboard, you know. And I actually saw George and I went to school with him. And of course, as I say, we went to, on the Empress of Russia, carrying these troops, we went to Freetown, West Africa. We went to Cape Town, Durban. We went from Durban to Ceylon. And that of course, was Colombo, we called in at. And then from Colombo, we went up to Port Tewfik and unloaded troops there.
Did you find it boring being on board ship?
No. No, I didn't, no.
Why not?
Well, I didn't because I used to make sure I had plenty to read when I was off watch. If there were any American ships nearby, we used to get things like the Saturday Evening Post, you know, Others, I forget, I think they may be defunct now, some of them. But we used to get things like that all the time. Magazines, you know, we used to pass them ship to ship. Like the time we went to through the Panama Canal on the Clan McNair. We got friendly with a vicar, and he gave us a tea, and he gave us a big pile of books. And I remember going to watch this American Army band, and then he told us, he says, we've got... I remember smiling at the time, he said, we've got no industry here at all, he said, except vice, and I forget what the other was, the canal, you know, brothels and the canal. That's all we've got here, he said. And he gave us piles of American magazines.
Excuse me. I think you were saying that you, in Russia, going back to Russia, you had some contact with Russian servicemen.
Oh, yes. There were quite a lot of people there who were... of course, had been injured, but they still didn't get sent home. I met one Russian sergeant pilot. That, I gathered that was his rank. And he could speak a little English. And his arm, well, he would have had a pension immediately in Britain. There he was sent to work on the in Murmansk. And the people we worked with always were short of a cigarette. We always kept them supplied with cigarettes. We kept them away from the ammunition, of course. We had more sense than that. But they used to use stuff, I think they called it mahorka. I think it was mahorka. And I used to hear the word tabak. We picked those words up, and I remember we learned odd words like das fidanya, I believe that's good evening or something, and dobrodin, good night, I think, and spasibo, I think that's thank you, from what I can remember, and odd words like that. And I remember we used to watch these Russian lads taking out the stuff in slings, and I've never found out what they were actually saying. They used to shout virai and minai. I thought that was up and down. But since then, I've spoken to Russian-speaking people and they're not quite sure what I'm talking about, but they seem to know.
You said they were talking in whispers all the time.
Oh, yes. They never let any of their officers hear them talking to us, not confidentially, and they tell us things like they can go in the club, but we can't. They won't allow us in the club. They didn't like that system at all. And the Russian officers all had shaven heads. They looked right bully boys to me. And I believe they behaved a bit that way towards the ordinary soldiers. Also, there were people up there that I thought or I'd gathered were there for criminal offences. Well, criminal offences in Russia, we don't know what those are. And they were up there. And as I said, they had... And I think it was a half-hour break in 12 hours and all they got were this... cabbage soup stuff. It smelled vile.